who died 3 years ago, but we could never bridge the gap between being combat-jacked and being civilians. We tried to work it out with a relator, but the relator had never been jacked, so we might as well have been talking Sanskrit. I don't know that it would be love with Sarah, but it's academic. She's not really attracted to me, and of course can't hide her feelings, or lack of same. In a physical way, we're closer than any civilian pair could be, since in full combat, Jack, we are this one creature, with 20 arms and legs, with 10 brains, with 5 vaginas and 5 penises. Some people call the feeling godlike, and I think there have been gods who were constructed along similar lines. The one I grew up with was an old white-bearded Caucasian gent, without even one vagina. We'd already studied the order of battle, of course, and our specific orders for the 9 days. We were going to continue in Scoville's area, but doing H&I, making things difficult in the cloud forest of Costa Rica. It was not a particularly dangerous assignment, but it was distasteful, like bullying, since the rebels didn't have anything remotely like soldier boys. Ralph expressed his discomfort. We had sat down at the dining table with tea and coffee. "This overkill gets to me," he said. "That pear in the tree last time?" "Ugly," Sarah said. "Ah, the bastards killed themselves," Mel said. He sipped the coffee and scowled at it. "We probably wouldn't have noticed them if they hadn't opened up on us."
"It bothers you that they were children?" I asked Ralph.
"Well, yeah. Doesn't it you?"
He rubbed the stubble on his chin.
"Little girls?"
"Little girls with machine guns," Karen said, and Claude nodded emphatically. "They'd come in together about a year ago and were lovers."
"I've been thinking about that, too," I said.
"What if we'd known they were little girls?"
"They'd been about 10 years old, hiding in a treehouse."
"Before or after they started shooting?" Mel asked.
"Even after," Candy said. "How much damage can they do with a machine gun?"
"They damaged me pretty effectively," Mel said.
He'd lost one eye and the olfactory receptors.
"They knew exactly what to aim for."
"It wasn't a big deal," Candy said. "You got field replacements."
"Felt like a big deal to me."
"I know. I was there."
"You don't exactly feel pain when a sensor goes out. It's something as strong as pain, but there's no word for it."
"I don't think we would have had to kill them if they were out in the open," Claude said. "If we could see, they were just kids and lightly armed, but hell, for all we knew, they were FOs who could call and attack nuke."
"In Costa Rica?" Candy said.
"It happens," Karen said.
It had happened once in 3 years. Nobody knew where the rebels had gotten the nuke. It had cost them 2 towns, the one the soldier boys were in when they were vaporized, and the one we took apart in retaliation.
"Yeah, yeah," Candy said,
and I could hear in those 2 words all she wasn't saying, that a nuke on our position would just destroy 10 machines. When Mel flamed the treehouse, he roasted 2 little girls, probably too young to know what they were doing. There was always an undercurrent in Candy's mind when we were jacked. She was a good mechanic, but you had to wonder why she hadn't been given some other assignment. She was too empathetic, sure to crack before her term was up. But maybe she was in the platoon to act as our collective conscience. Nobody at our level knew why anybody was chosen to be a mechanic, and we only had a vague idea why we were assigned to the platoon we got. We seemed to cover a wide range of aggressiveness, from Candy to Mel. We didn't have anybody like Scoville, though. Nobody who got that dark pleasure out of killing. Scoville's platoon always saw more action than mine, too. No coincidence. Hunter-killers. They're definitely more congenial with mayhem. So when the great computer in the sky decides who gets what mission, Scoville's platoon gets the kills, and ours gets reconnaissance. Mel and Claude, especially, grumbled about that. A confirmed kill was an automatic point toward promotion, in pay grade, if not in rank, whereas you couldn't count on the PPR, periodic performance review, for a dime. Scoville's people got the kills, so they averaged about 25% higher pay than my people. But what could you spend it on? Save it up and buy our way out of the army? "So we're gonna do trucks," Mel said. "Cars and trucks." "That's the word," I said. "Maybe a tank if you hold your mouth right." Satellites had picked up some IR traces that probably meant the rebels were being resupplied by small, stealthed trucks, probably robotic or remote. One of those outburst technology that kept the war from being a totally one-sided massacre. I suppose if the war went on long enough, the enemy might have soldier boys, too. Then we could have the ultimate in something, $10 million machines reducing each other to junk, while their operators sat hundreds of miles away, concentrating in air-conditioned caves. People had written about that, warfare based on attrition of wealth rather than loss of life, but it's always been easier to make new lives than new wealth. And economic battles have long established venues, some political and some not, as often among allies as not. Well, what does a physicist know about it? My science has rules and laws that seem to correspond to reality. Economics describes reality after the fact, but isn't too good at predicting. Nobody predicted the nanoforges. The loudspeaker told us to saddle up. 9 days of truck stalking. All 10 people in Julian Class's platoon had the same basic weapon, the Soldier Boy, or Remote Infantry Combat Unit. A huge suit of armor with a ghost in it. For all the weight of its armor, more than half of the RICU's mass was ammunition. It could fire accurate sniper rounds to the horizon, 2 ounces of depleted uranium, or at close range it could hose a stream of supersonic flechettes. It had high explosive and incendiary rockets with eyes, a fully automatic grenade launcher, and a high-powered laser. Special units could be fitted with chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, but those were only used for reprisal in kind. Fewer than a dozen nuclear weapons, small ones, had been used in 12 years of war. A large one had destroyed Atlanta. And although the Nagumi denied responsibility, the Alliance responded by giving 24 hours notice, and then leveling Mandelaville and Sao Paulo. Nagumi contended that the Alliance had cynically sacrificed one non-strategic city so it could have an excuse to destroy 2 important ones. Julian suspected they might be right. There were air and naval units, too, inevitably called flyboys and sailor boys, even though most flyboys were piloted by females. All of Julian's platoon had the same armor and weapons, but some had specialized functions. Julian, being platoon leader, communicated directly and, in theory, constantly with the company coordinator, and through her to the brigade command. In the field, he received constant input in the form of encrypted signals from flyover satellites, as well as the command station in geosynchronous orbit. Every order came from 2 sources simultaneously, with different encryption and a different transmission lag, so it would be almost impossible for the enemy to slip in a bogus command. Ralph had a horizontal link, similar to Julian's vertical one. As platoon liaison, he was in touch with his opposite number in each of the other 9 platoons that made up Bravo. They were lightly jacked. The communication wasn't as intimate as he had with other members of the platoon, but it was more than just a radio link. He could advise Julian as to the other platoon's actions, and even feelings, morale, in a quick and direct way. It was rare for all the platoons to be engaged in a single action, but when they were, the situation was chaotic and confusing. The platoon liaisons then were as important as the vertical command links. One soldier boy platoon could do as much damage as a brigade of regular infantry. They did it quicker and more dramatically, like huge, invincible robots moving in silent concert. They didn't use actual armed robots for several reasons. One was that they couldn't be captured and used against you. If the enemy could capture a soldier boy, they would just have an expensive piece of junk. None had ever been captured intact, though. They self-destruct, impressively. Another problem with robots was autonomy. The machine has to be able to function on its own if communications are cut off. The image, as well as the reality, of a heavily armed machine making spot combat decisions was not something any army wanted to deal with. Soldier boys had limited autonomy in case their mechanics died or passed out. They stopped firing and went for shelter, while a new mechanic was warmed up and jacked. The soldier boys were arguably more effective psychological weapons than robots would be. They were like all-powerful knights, heroes, and they represented a technology that was out of the enemy's grasp. The enemy did use armed robots, like, as it turned out, the 2 tanks that were guarding the convoy of trucks that Julian's platoon was sent to destroy. Neither of the tanks caused any trouble. In both cases, they were destroyed as soon as they revealed their position by firing. 24 robot trucks were destroyed, too, after their cargoes had been examined, ammunition and medical supplies. After the last truck had been reduced to shiny slag, the platoon still had 4 days left on its shift, so they were flown back to the Portobello base camp to do picket duty. That could be pretty dangerous, since the base camp was hit by rockets a couple of times a year, but most of the time it was no challenge. Not boring, though. The mechanics were protecting their own lives for a change. Sometimes it took me a couple of days to wind down and be ready to be a civilian again. There were plenty of joints in Portobello willing to help ease the transition. I usually did my unwinding back in Houston, though. It was easy for rebels to slip across the border and pass as Panamanians, and if you got tagged as a mechanic, you were a prime target. Of course, there were plenty of other Americans and Europeans in Portobello, but it's possible that mechanics stood out. Pale and twitchy, collars pulled up to hide the skulljacks, or wigs. We lost one that way last month. Arlie went into town for a meal and a movie. Some thugs pulled off her wig, and she was hauled into an alley and beaten to a pulp and raped. She didn't die, but she didn't recover either. They had pounded the back of her head against a wall until the skull fractured and the jack came out. They shoved the jack into her vagina and left her for dead. So, the platoon was one short this month. The Neo personnel delivered couldn't fit Arlie's cage, which was not surprising. We may be short, too, next month. Samantha, who is Arlie's best friend, and a little bit more, was hardly there this week. Brooding, distracted, slow. If we'd been in actual combat, she might have snapped out of it. Both of them were pretty good soldiers. Better than me in terms of actually liking the work. But picket duty gave her too much time to meditate. And the truck assignment before that was a silly exercise a flyboy could have done on her way back from something else. We all tried to give Samantha support while we were jacked, but it was awkward. Of course, she and Arlie couldn't hide their physical attraction for one another. but they were both conventional enough to be embarrassed about it. They had boyfriends on the outside, and had encouraged kids